Oh, Tom. Matt Puballo with you, everybody. Tom Hush, our producer, and he decided to put Professor Betsy Bryan through that. I apologize, Professor Bryan. I'm sure you've never been introduced to Walk Like an Egyptian before.
Actually, I love Walk Like an Egyptian.
Oh, good. Well, Tom's very happy with himself. Now, thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Professor Betsy Bryan. She's a professor of Egyptology at Johns Hopkins University. We appreciate you coming on the phone with us. When there's a discovery like this, and what seems like an entire city amazingly intact, how excited does that get you?
Oh, it has really been really a wonderful, wonderful time for those of us who are interested in ancient Egypt and particularly in the ancient Egyptian people. It is so exciting, and I was just so lucky to be able to be in Egypt in order to be able to actually go there and see it. Fabulous.
Now, explain to us a little bit about what was found. If I'm reading correctly, this isn't a brand new discovery. It was discovered in a couple of years ago, it sounds like, or at least started unearthing a couple of years ago, and now you guys are really getting to what remains of the city. I see pictures of amazing amounts of city that have been uncovered and largely intact.
Well, that's right. Now, actually, this particular excavation really only started last fall. The Zahi Hawass, who's the primary excavator here, has another excavation in the Valley of the Kings, which is nearby. But this is one that they just started this past fall. And in the amazing short 5 months, they have really, in fact, unearthed what is a major part of the city. Now, this city is one that was known to have been existing, but no one knew it was in this area as well. There is a palace about half of a mile to the south of where they're working now, that is of the same date from the same king, and basically people thought that was it. But now we realize that with this excavation, it's turning out that this is going to be rival, certainly, the other largest royal city we have in ancient Egypt, and that's at Amarna, about 200 miles to the north of there. So this is going to turn out to be truly the precursor, the place that started what became Amarna a few years later, when the son of the king who built this city picked up and moved away.
Okay, so you say that there's a palace not far away, and that was thought of what was there. Explain to me how this works, because I see that there's this full city kind of underground. How does that happen? A city is abandoned, and then just over centuries, dust and sand and everything, just the way the earth moves things around, covers up what was there?
That is basically exactly what happens when you visit there. You'll see that it is in the quote-unquote desert, and wind will carry sand very quickly that will cover up, particularly, these are mud brick buildings, and the dirt just fills them up in a very, very quick fashion. So they told me that literally within the first few centimeters that they remove, say an inch or two of earth that they began to remove, they started to have walls. Mm. And some of these walls are still preserved to 10 or 12 feet in height. It's staggering. But what's even more staggering is it's not just the completeness, but it really is the place where so let me explain. There was a king, and he was living in this palace and building the city that we're talking about for about 10 to 15 years. And this is happening around 1370 BC, so a long time ago, 3,700 years ago. I can't even do it. I'm too tired. 3,300 years ago. And he had a son, And his son turned out to be a heretic. His son is kind of famous among Egyptologists. His name was Akhenaten. And he decided that he only believed in one God, and that was the sun up in the sky. And so he decided that he wanted to build himself a new city and go and worship his God alone in that city. So after his father died, he continued to live in this city where they're working now for about 5 years. And in 5 years, the city that he was building 200 miles away was finally finished. And he sort of just yelled, "Okay, we're leaving now." And everybody dropped everything. They picked up what they needed to go with, and they got on boats, and they got on donkeys, and they left. And they went to this new city of Amarna. So the city that was left, which is what they're now excavating down there in modern Luxor, ancient Thebes, was still there with all the stuff left on the ground. And it is, it's a marvel. You just don't find things like that with the pottery that they were using, they were making sandals. There is a heap of leather sandals. There's a place where there was a dead cow, and the cow they had used for every possible use. They had used the skin to make these sandals. They had made food with the cow, and all of this is right there, and it's the kind of record of human life that you just often. You're just so lucky to one day get it because it's rare.
It's amazing. We're speaking with Professor Betsy Bryan of Johns Hopkins University about this city that is being unearthed in Egypt, looking back 3,000 plus years. Find out more next, 720 WGN. Professor Betsy Bryan is on the phone with us from Johns Hopkins University. Do you get introduced with King Tut too, Steve Martin? I bet you get that one too, right?
We love that one too. And we love all the mummy movies.
You are the most fun Egyptologist I've ever met, Professor Bryan. I really appreciate that.
Well, thanks.
So when you're seeing a city like this, and everybody, if you just search online, CNN.com, National Geographic had a great story. I'm sure Tom will maybe see if he can post any photos when he puts up the podcast of this interview. But like you said, the walls, like 10 feet tall, like you're walking through a city you guys have uncovered. This must be painstaking work to delicately unearth to figure out what you can remove and what you need to be careful to save. How long does it take? Because what I'm seeing is a picture of what looks like almost about half of a football field.
Yes, that's true. And that is the fact that this particular expedition, which is an Egyptian expedition, they have access to excellent archaeologists and also large numbers of trained workers who, frankly, could just move an awful lot of dirt. And once they realize that they're, for example, a pot is emerging, that's when they have to slow down and be very careful and work around it and almost use a brush in many cases to remove the dirt. And what they're doing is really purposefully leaving the large complete pots in place, leaving it so that you can really see when you walk through there what was left on the ground. Now, they also have an area that is, I would say, it's huge, you know, at least the size of a tennis court, no, maybe two tennis courts, where they have laid out broken pottery pieces, and each of them is laid out according to which room it comes from. There are so many rooms in this village, and they're divided up into craft specialization areas. There are these walls that are zigzag-shaped that separate these craft specialization areas. And this is something that the ancient Egyptians didn't really do very much, and it's one reason you can tell that all of this has been done by a king, for a king, because it is so much, frankly, larger and fancier than you would normally get in a village. And so they have to really be very careful, but at the same time, they are removing pieces that are broken so that they can study them and see if they can actually put them back together. But they have a very well organized area where everything is laid out and can be tracked. And the documentation is going on constantly. So they're photographing, they're doing 3D photographing, and they're keeping paper records of everything.
You mentioned the walls in the picture. The walls do zigzag back and forth, almost like semicircle back in, semicircle back in. Do we know why that was? Was that a protector of something?
Well, it's really interesting because it is a technique that you see in a few other places that this king, the same king, Amenhotep III, was building. But really, the main reason to use it is because you can make a much more stable, stronger wall with only a brick or in a brick and a half thickness. So because of that winding back and forth, you have a hard time pushing it over, even when the wind blows very hard, which of course it does across the desert. So that's the main reason for doing it. But I think in this particular instance, the additional reason is because they are really using them to create sort of enclosed areas that are separated intentionally. So as you move from one to the other, you can actually see the difference where one is a food preparation area in large scale, and the next one over, there are kilns for making pottery and special kinds of even glass making. So it's so each area has been divided off by these walls.
What do you hope to find from this? I mean, this is amazing and so cool, and you're seeing how they built in things, but what do you take from this today? What does this teach you that's new that maybe you didn't know before about ancient Egypt or ancient civilization?
Well, I mean, I think for me, it's a little bit of what I was just talking about, that this is the first time we can see in a really close way, in large numbers, the actual way in which they could produce mass amounts of really high quality luxury items. And that's something that this particular king and this time period, because this guy is the grandfather of Tutankhamun, this is a time when they were producing some of the most luxurious, beautiful art they ever produced. And here we're actually seeing the places they did it and what they built and how they went about making, scaling it up to a level that you would never see in your average village or town in ancient Egypt. So for me, it's like I can see this and then I can immediately think of what went into the tomb of Tutankhamun, and I'm seeing the place where a lot of that kind of stuff is being made and the process. So it really adds to the enormous impact of what went into a royal tomb burial like Tut's tomb.
Does finding something like this give you great hope for other discoveries that must be out there when something this old is this well preserved, or is this an anomaly?
Well, that's a great question, and I do think it gives us great hope, because to be quite honest, where they're digging, people really thought this was one of the few places that they weren't going to be finding much of anything. So now we know that this entire area, probably both to the south and the north of it, are going to be continuously like this. So there are going to be many more football fields revealed of this town. And that's, to me, extremely exciting. And who knows what they're going to find.
What happens, say, 5-10 years when you've uncovered everything here and done all the studying and taken all the pictures? Does this become a World Heritage Site, or does somebody say some condos would look great right there?
Oh, you know, that's another really super question, and they are already talking about doing some kind of capping of these mud brick walls with material that will allow them not to have to rebury them. Because in the past, archaeologists could not allow mud brick walls to be left out because the elements would actually ruin them and erode them. So, but nowadays, there really are ways in which you can apply material on top of them that caps them, that can then allow you to leave them and make it a World Heritage Site. People wouldn't probably be able to walk through it, but you could walk around it and, you know, very closely and still see an enormous amount. And I think that's exactly what will probably happen.
Professor Betsy Bryan from Johns Hopkins University got to walk and dig and see it live and in person. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone with us.